Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Pennsylvania is at full employment. That is, if you go by the unemployment rate. It was at 3.8% in June, tying the record set in April for the lowest since records began being kept in 1976. Those numbers are great news, but they don't tell the whole story. Many Pennsylvania employers need skilled workers to fill positions they have open. So how do workers get the training and education they need? And we can talk about the labor force overall today with our guest, Eileen Cipriani, Deputy Secretary for Workforce Development at the Pennsylvania Department of Labor and Industry. Deputy Secretary Cipriani, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott. Great to be here today.
Also joining us, Jesse McCree, CEO of South Central PA Works. Mr. McCree, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Scott. Great to be here.
And Jeff Newman of the Center for Workforce Information and Analysis. Jeff Newman, you're going to be analyzing a lot of these figures for us, aren't you?
I'll do my best.
All right. Well, we have about 40 minutes where we have this conversation today. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can also leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Deputy Secretary Cipriani, let me start with you. I mentioned in the introduction, full employment, that would seem to be the ultimate. Record-setting unemployment rate, tying us with April, Pennsylvania, with April's 3.8%. But as we talk about this more, obviously those numbers are not the ultimate goal, are they?
No, they're not the ultimate goal. What those numbers reflect is the number of people that are looking for jobs in the Commonwealth today, that 3.8. That's what that encompasses. But what we work very hard on in workforce development are those other individuals that are trying to get into jobs that maybe are long-term unemployed, single parents, veterans, older individuals, English as a second language, individuals that have barriers to getting into good-paying jobs in Pennsylvania. So that's the focus of the public workforce system and what we're working on very hard right now in Pennsylvania.
You know, something you just mentioned, though, often this conversation, and I'll admit that we in the media have a tendency to focus on those unemployment numbers because it is a number. Yes, 3.8% is a good thing compared to, say, 10% unemployment. It says that we have a good economy. It says that there are a lot of people working. It says that there are not as many people looking for jobs. But at the same time, something that strikes me just what you said is, in the past, it seems as though we haven't talked as much about employers and what employers are looking for. Yeah, we want to get people into jobs, but today the conversation seems to have turned toward, we have employers out there who have jobs to fill, and we have people who could fill them, but they don't have the training. Jesse, I see you nodding.
Yeah, it's really a remarkable time right now for Pennsylvania as a whole and for Central Pennsylvania specifically. You know, a recent survey by the Pennsylvania Chamber of Business and Industry that came out last fall showed that the biggest challenge for Pennsylvania businesses right now is not healthcare costs, it's not taxes, it's not deregulation, it's finding and training and keeping a skilled workforce. So the number one thing that's keeping businesses awake at night is finding people and keeping them. It's a workforce development issue. And I think what's so remarkable about that is then in talking to businesses, we're seeing that there is an increased investment that businesses are willing to make in training their own people. And it's also something where, as a convener, a workforce development board, with our state partners, with economic development, with K-12 education, this is a really great opportunity for us to do exactly what Eileen just said, which is bringing those people that have been on the sidelines in the labor force and bringing them into the labor force, training them and keeping them there is really going to be good for Pennsylvania as a whole. And I think one of the things that as we see that this is the number one challenge for Pennsylvania businesses right now, this is our opportunity to drive the Commonwealth forward as a great place to live and to work. So workforce development really is a catalyst in coalescing around a lot of different issues with economic development, education, and workforce development. So this is really an important thing. And back to your point about unemployment rate not telling the full story, to me, the labor force participation rate is one of the most important statistics that we can look at. What are the number of people that are participating in the labor force? And it really sort of adds a layer of some detail to that unemployment rate, which is how many people are actually in the labor force. So as we see that labor force participation rate slowly ticking up, I think that's really healthy for our region.
Well, and that brings up a good point. And I think sometimes we have to provide some context and some background here. That unemployment rate doesn't count the people who are not actively seeking employment that may have said they've given up. It happens very often, it seems, just an observation. It happens very often when times are tough. Mm-hmm. Someone has been out of work for a long time. They look for something else to do. But that's another reason that that unemployment rate is not a good barometer or the best barometer, because it doesn't count those people who are not actively seeking jobs, correct?
Correct. I think one of the important things about the rate isn't the number itself. It's that it's calculated the same way month after month, year after year. So whether that number is 3.8% or 5.2% or 2.1%, you can look back and see what has it done over the year, what has it done over the last 3 years, what has it done over the last 5 years, whatever time period you want, and you can make that comparison or look at that graph where it's been steadily decreasing since the recession and say it's a good barometer of the directions we're going in.
Mm-hmm. See, I didn't want to spend a whole lot of time on the program talking about the unemployment rate. Just wanted to establish that right up front. But just to provide a little more context with some of these jobs that are being filled, are these good paying jobs? Are these jobs that would, you know, we use that term family sustaining jobs. Now, I don't know what if there is actually an official number of or a wage that counts as a family sustaining job. But the jobs that are being filled, that have been filled over the past few years, are those jobs that families can live on?
Well, and to pick up on something Jesse said with the training, when you look at these jobs that are open, right now there's a lot of jobs in healthcare, your RNs, your PTs, your OTs.
Those are good paying jobs. Right.
Cybersecurity, good paying job. Construction, good paying jobs. CNC machinists, they're always in high demand. So these are good paying jobs. But what Jesse had touched on before, the training part, a lot of times we have people that are unemployed or looking for work that do not have the technical skill set that matches these jobs. So that's where we come in. That's the importance of the public workforce system to help individuals get that training they need to get themselves into these good paying jobs.
Okay. So, Jesse, I think I want to just clarify here. You said number one priority of Pennsylvania employers, and I'm assuming you're talking about getting those workers out there the skills they need to fill those jobs, correct?
Correct. Yeah, right now there are, in South Central Pennsylvania, in our 8-county region that we serve, there are more job openings right now than there are official unemployed people. And so what that speaks to is that there are businesses that really are, they're desperate for workers, for a skilled workforce. And so that is their number one concern. You know, the other thing too that I think is interesting with regards to the jobs that are out there, we really use locally as a workforce development board, we use MIT's living wage data, which speaks to the number of people you have in your household, what county you live in, and giving you a number of a dollar per hour that would allow you to support your family, a family sustaining wage, a living wage. And importantly for the investments that we're making in partnership with Eileen and her team is investing in the high growth, high priority occupations that have a projection of wage growth over the next 5 or 10 years. Those are the jobs that we need to be training local Pennsylvanians in. And I think it's also important that those are the jobs that businesses are coming to us and saying, for CNC machinists, we have an aging workforce. We have people that have been here for so long. We don't have a pipeline of younger people, younger workers that are able to move into these jobs. So it's really important for us to look at those people that are not in the labor force or those who are on the sidelines, as we call them, and giving them the skills, the training, and the education to compete for those high growth, high priority occupations that fit into that living wage scale that we think is really important.
When we use the terminology a skilled workforce, what are we talking about? I mean, what kind of skills are we talking about?
I think it's a pretty broad range. I mean, I think there is a lot of times when we talk to businesses, we're talking about the essential skills. Some people call them work-ready skills. Some people call them soft skills.
Soft skills,
it's
right,
ability to show up, to have a work ethic, to be able to work with your team, problem solve, to be able to, you know, sort of triage issues that come in, to be able to take supervision. And we're seeing that those essential skills are really critical for businesses right now. On the other side of it, we have the technical skills. Eileen, you alluded to, we have a lot of warehouse and distribution jobs around here. Well, what are the trends happening across the country? Automation, robotics, AI. We need to train a workforce that is skilled and qualified, nimble and adaptive to be able to partake in this, the changes, the structural changes in our labor force. So I think we're seeing that you could call them the soft skills and the hard skills, and both of them are needed. The most important thing that we're seeing, just as a wrap up to that point, we need to talk to businesses about what they need. We can't just put a class together and train people and hope that the skills that they're getting are going to be relevant in the labor market, but rather we need to go talk to businesses, interview them, and then sort of reverse engineer those classes to make sure that those skills are demand driven. That's the most critical thing that we as a workforce board can do.
You know, you mentioned those soft skills. Are those actually part of job training? Because again, hosting this show over the years, I've heard that many times that, we have problems getting people to show up on time, to not want to take vacation after a week of working, that kind of thing, to be able to have communication skills. But I don't often hear the soft skills mentioned with when an employer says, I need a skilled workforce. Most of the time, they're talking about someone who has the skills to operate the machinery or to perform the jobs that they have rather than just showing up on time.
Well, I think they're talking about both, because sometimes you'll talk to a business and they'll say, I will train this individual if they have those work-ready skills. So we've really put a strong focus on those work-ready skills and putting a lot of programs into place to help our students. And one of them, we have a very robust internship program, which gives students the opportunity.
Who's we? When you say we?
The Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
All right, okay.
So this is under the governor's jurisdiction. It's called the State and Local Internship Program, and all of our local boards participate in it. But it gives students an opportunity to get into the workforce, see what that culture's like, see what's required of them in the workforce. So it's been really exciting. One of the other things that we've done is we really flipped the switch, and this was Governor Wolf's initiative that he was, he really pushed forward, was teacher in the workplace. So we're sending teachers to the workplace so the teachers hear from businesses firsthand, what are you looking for in an employee? Now take that back in your classroom, and that's part of your everyday classroom activities. It's not a separate class. It's not something. It's part of your educational process. So we're really excited about that.
Jeff Newman, how did we get to this point where, I mean, we touched on the population, the workforce getting older, but that's not everything. How do we get to a point where Pennsylvania, it's not just Pennsylvania, though, it's across the country, does not have the skilled workforce that it needs?
Well, I think that the problem is the industries have changed over the years. The in-demand industries have changed, and we need the people who are ready to take those positions. One example is a lot of the manufacturing jobs. If you would have gone, say, for the last 10 years to a career day or something at a high school, they'd be talking about computer-type jobs, they'd be talking about healthcare-type jobs, and they probably would not be focusing on manufacturing jobs because we were losing jobs overseas, robotics was taking away jobs. But we have that workforce getting older, and the people that are in those jobs are going to be retiring or are retiring, and we need skilled people to take their place.
We'll talk about the education and training in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. I want to talk about some programs that we have coming up in the very near future here on Smart Talk, such as online gambling starting here in Pennsylvania, treatment for HIV, and student debt. Those are just some of the topics that we'll be addressing over the next few days. We invite you to share your questions in advance by sending us a voice memo or leaving a voicemail. See what's coming up at WITF.org/smarttalk. Today we're talking about Well, workforce development, I guess, are a lot of ways to describe what we're discussing today. Workforce development sounds so generic, though. What we're talking about is trying to line up Pennsylvania employers with Pennsylvanians who are seeking good jobs, getting the kind of training, the kind of education that they need, family-sustaining jobs. We have low unemployment right now. There are a lot of jobs out there, some paying very well, but you need training. We're talking about all of those things today. Our guest, Jeff Newman of the Center for Workforce Information and Analysis, Jesse McCree, CEO of South Central PA Works, and Eileen Cipriani, Deputy Secretary for Workforce Development at the Pennsylvania Department of Labor and Industry. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Got an email here, and yeah, I'll pass this along as kind of a public service message. A caller says on August 10th, the Keystone Contractors Association, along with the Boys and Girls Club of Harrisburg, will host a Construction Careers Day at the Harrisburg Boys and Girls Club, free for all ages, 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Just an observation. I'm noticing more announcements like that. And again, I think it's a sign of there are jobs out there. Construction industry, probably one of those industries that could use more skilled workers, right?
Right. And, you know, another thing that's important about that email is they're looking for to attract younger individuals. So they want to put that message in front of younger students, elementary, middle school students, so that they can start learning about careers, career exploration, career awareness, to make better decisions as they get older.
All right, then you led right into what I wanted to discuss next, and that is younger people who are maybe in high school deciding what they want to do career-wise, whether they want to go to a four-year college, what their major will be. It seems as though over the past 20 or 30 years or so, that's the path that we've pointed so many young people to. That four-year degree, you need that bachelor's degree to be successful. And we look at the statistics. Statistics say you have a bachelor's degree, you probably will earn more money than a person who has an associate's degree or a high school graduate. But at the same time, that's one of the reasons that a lot of these skilled positions are going unfilled. Why? How do we get away from just pointing everyone in one direction?
Well, I think it's about changing the narrative. And I think we have made some significant strides in that direction. Getting the message out, you don't need a four-year education to find a family-sustaining career. Community colleges have some phenomenal programs. And basically what you need is some form of post-secondary education or training. One of the best examples we have right now of great training is apprenticeship programs. And we have, in the past 3 years, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, under Governor Wolf and now under his PA Smart program, have put a significant level of resources into apprenticeships in the Commonwealth. We now have over 17,000 apprentices in over 800 programs, and they range from your construction, which we've talked about, to manufacturing, to healthcare, and to IT. So we have the whole breadth of occupations in it, but it gives individuals the opportunity to earn while they learn without racking up debt and getting a good skilled job.
You know, Jeff, something you said earlier about how technology has changed, how the workforce has changed, how the jobs have changed. But I think you can't help, when we have this discussion, we can't have it without thinking about what things used to be like. Mm-hmm. It used to be that there are many times where you could graduate high school and walk right into a manufacturing job where you were making good money. For the most part, that is not the case today. But at the same time, and can I ask you the same question I did, Deputy Secretary, of how do we point, and it's not just young people, but how do we point people toward, make them realize, and when you were talking about apprenticeships, again, I think back to more than 20 or 30 years ago, this is the way that people became a skilled professional, is that they worked with someone as an apprentice. What can apprenticeship bring?
I'm going to defer to Jesse on this question because he has been chomping at the bit to say something, and this is really more up his alley.
Can you tell he's chomping?
Fidgeting a little bit here. Yeah. No, it's a great question. So I think there's a couple factors, and we've alluded to them. We're looking to prepare our young people and adult workers as well to be college and career ready, and it's important to make sure that those are not mutually exclusive. I also think that there's the career pathways that are being built that I think what apprenticeships do is it allows young people to learn to work by working. It allows them to get their hands dirty and allows them to have that experience to see if it's something that they want to pursue as a career. There's the training that goes alongside of working that we think is a really powerful combination. But here's an example, I think, of the narrative that we need to change about what these jobs, particularly in advanced manufacturing, look like. There's a great company down in York. I'll mention them by name because we work closely with them, Weldon Solutions, and they produce a lot of parts for robots, right? So they have robotics as a really key part of their manufacturing. When we bring young students into Weldon Solutions, and there are a plethora of other great organizations and companies like Weldon, there is a wow factor that happens when young people see, I can take my training and my desire to get my hands dirty and to build something and to engineer something and to work with machines, yet also have this great organization that's building robots that's actually helping to make parts. I mean, there's a wow factor where you take these STEM occupations and you can put that on top of the advanced manufacturing, the industries that are in our DNA here in South Central Pennsylvania. And you can really see that young people have that understanding that not all advanced manufacturing is that dark, dirty, and dangerous, but rather it is exciting. There's the STEM occupations, and I think apprenticeship really feeds in well to those type of occupations.
See, Jesse, something I was going to point out is you use the terminology, get your hands dirty.
Right.
That's traditionally maybe why some people opt not to get into, go to a vo-tech, as it used to be called, or a tech school, is because I don't want to get my hands dirty. I want to work in a job where I'm in an office setting, I'm in a hospital or something like that, that I don't work well with my hands. So using the terminology, get your hands dirty, is that the right way to go about it nowadays?
It's probably a better way to say, get the experience, get the hands-on experience, right? And so places like
although these, there are some that want to get their hands dirty.
Absolutely. And I think it's showing and changing the narrative, like you said, Eileen, that these jobs that need more than a high school diploma but less than a four-year degree, training, on-the-job training, apprenticeships, associate's degrees, that are really highly paid jobs that are perfect for a lot of people that have that mind and that desire to work with their hands. But they're beautiful facilities, right? Where they're clean. It's not our grandparents' manufacturing, as we like to say. And it's exciting to see that our region is really growing with those type of occupations.
Let's take a phone call from Syria. Syria, you're on the air.
Hi. It's actually Kiara.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. I just wanted to say that those programs are really fantastic. I graduated from high school a long time ago, and I had no direction. I did not know what to do. I didn't have any skills, and I actually went through the Department of Public Assistance, and they put me in a program called Abo Haven in Philadelphia. And, I mean, they trained me, and I ended up, before the program, I was making maybe $7 an hour. After the program, I had started at an insurance company for $15, and those programs are amazing. Things that I didn't learn in high school, they taught me.
Mm-hmm. Hey, thank you very much. Well, okay, but before I go any further, when you say things you didn't learn in high school, they taught you, like what?
So something as simple as how to dress for an interview. I mean, I was 18, so I thought, you have to look good. And you have to realize that club good is not the same as interview good.
Well said.
Yeah, if you would have showed up looking club good for some jobs, that might not be a good idea. I like the way she put that. Thank you very much for your call.
Scott, if we can go back to one thing Jesse said for a second, when we're talking about the training and being both college ready and being career ready, one of the programs that we have, and speak to us specifically, it's called New Paths. It's an IT pre-apprenticeship program. And in this program, students can earn college credits, they can get industry recognized certifications, and then they could also enter into, once they graduate, into an apprenticeship program in your IT field. So we're talking cybersecurity, we're talking help desk and coding. And Jesse's local area just graduated the first class of adults that went back into this, but we also have it in high schools. And I don't know if you want to talk about it a little bit more specifically, because it's a really great way to use apprenticeships in the IT space.
So we've had a great partnership with Harrisburg University. They've been wonderful to work with. And not only with this New Paths program, this essentially is, you know, a pre-apprenticeship and apprenticeship program for IT jobs, we've also been able to take this into the high schools. So we have this program that we refer to as our STEM summer camps, or our Raspberry Pi, which is essentially a computer that it's a computer kit that kids can build. So what we do is we have a two-week STEM summer camp over the summer, and we bring high school students in from Harrisburg, from Lebanon, from York. They're at Harrisburg University. They're building a computer that they get to take home at the end. And importantly, they get a college credit at the end of that camp. So what we're doing is we're having young people see these are the jobs and the careers that are in high growth fields or high priority occupations. But we're also allowing them to get some college credit and get some exposure to the higher education side of things to show that there are pathways moving forward for their lives that are outstanding. And again, these are really good jobs that are high paying, that are in high demand. So this Raspberry Pi STEM summer camp has been an outstanding success with Harrisburg University.
Jeff, what were we going to say? You look like you were chomping. Okay. I didn't recognize your chomp. I'll get to know that. I'm sure that if you ask most people in Pennsylvania, they know that there are programs available and that they can get some job training, they can get further education. So where's the disconnect? Why isn't everyone doing it if that be the case?
Well, part of it is we need to work really hard to get our message out about the benefits of the public workforce system. And programs like this and your help is phenomenal. But you're right. There are so many opportunities for individuals through our CareerLink system, through the public workforce system, for them to take advantage of, to get the education, the skills, the training they need to get into the marketplace and get into these good jobs.
All right. So how do they do it? Someone listening today saying, okay, here's something I would like to do, but I do not have the background. Do not have the education. How do they go about it?
They come down to our PA CareerLink site and come in and visit us. We have 57 CareerLinks throughout the entire state. They're in all over the Commonwealth. We also have a very robust online presence at pacareerlink.com, where you could go on, you could look for jobs, you could build your resume, you could do mock interviews, you could do an inventory of your talent and skill set so that you could get an idea about what you would like to look at. But you go down and you visit the CareerLinks that Jesse operates here right in Dauphin County, and really they will be able to take care of you, bring you in, help you, case manage you, and get you on the road to a successful career.
Okay, now maybe I'm thinking in the past, because when you refer to career links, that's what many people used to call the unemployment office.
That's not the case.
Yeah,
that is
that's
not
it.
You see, and that's just it. I mean, getting people that I'm not speaking for everyone, but there probably are a lot of people who think, okay, I go there when I don't have a job, and yes, I need a job. But you're saying that if someone is employed right now, but they want to change careers, they want to make a better career, that they can go to PA CareerLinks.
Absolutely. Yeah. We've really spent a lot of time changing that narrative about the Pennsylvania CareerLink and the brand. We are here to serve all job seekers here in South Central Pennsylvania, and we're here to serve businesses looking to find and keep that talented, skilled workforce. And so, as Eileen said, there's a skills assessment. There is one-on-one case management. There is being connected to open jobs. And then there's also funding and resources and programs that we provide for people that want to further their career with that training in it and the education that they need to continue on their career pathway. So we really see ourselves as a convener and a catalyst for all job seekers and all businesses in the region to make sure that South Central Pennsylvania and across the Commonwealth too is really a great place to live and to work. And so Pennsylvania CareerLink we're serving thousands of people a year, and we would welcome anyone who is looking for that next step in their career to come visit our offices.
Let's take a call from Egan in Lancaster. Egan, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Scott, the conversation sounds very, very optimistic and very upbeat. But there is a disconnect between people who want to work and the job scale they're able to use. I've heard soft skills mentioned as some of the basics for employment. Well, let's take the casino industry for an example, and where soft skills would probably be paramount important. I looked up the hourly wage for people in the casino industry, cashier, host, porter. The cashier makes $9 to $12 an hour. The host makes $8 to $11 an hour, and the porter makes $8 to $10 an hour. Now, those wages are not what was mentioned as the MIT standard of a living wage. So I think this conversation is overly optimistic. It's more advertisement and propaganda than fact.
Well, see, the thing is, I would disagree with you on that class, the way you clarify it. But I get your point as to what you're saying, that not everyone is going to walk into a high-paying job. But, yeah, I kind of resent you being called propaganda. Egan, thanks for your call anyway.
Well, Scott, just to touch on that a little bit, a lot of those jobs we consider transitional jobs. You start at one point, and Jesse touched on it before about a career pathway. So you start at one point, but you could come back into the career link and we can help upskill you, maybe get Microsoft Office, Excel, programs like that, maybe upskill your IT, and that now you can move on to a higher paying job in the casino industry if that's where you choose to stay. But your lifetime is about learning. You need to continue to learn to increase your skill set to move yourself up. So everyone has to start somewhere in a job. You know, I started making pizza. You know, I started, and then you move up. So a lot of those jobs, they're entry-level and transitional.
Mm-hmm. So, Jeff, tell me about the Center for Workforce Information Analysis. What do you do?
We are a bunch of math geeks. We analyze numbers. There are different programs that we work with in conjunction with the Bureau of Labor Statistics. For example, the jobs number that comes out every month I personally work in, that's called the Current Employment Statistics Program, and it's done at a national level by BLS, but they feed us information that we can use at the state level and even at the local level to come up with our monthly estimates for job growth.
Okay, we talked about the unemployment rate. What numbers stick out to you right now?
The big thing that sticks out to me is we've had two graphs going in completely opposite directions for the last 10 years. Unemployment rate has gone down. There may be months here and there where it ticked up a little, but the overall trend is going down, and jobs have gone up consistently.
All right, let me ask you about another number, wages. Okay. One of the unusual results of or aftermath of the Great Recession of 07, 08 is that it took a long time for wages to go up, even though we were at full employment, I should say, and employers were having trouble. They were competing to fill jobs, but wages haven't kept up. Are they starting to go up now?
The wages have increased, but not as much as we would think they should with the demand for workers out there. Typically, when you're in that kind of a period, the wage increases would be higher and fat more quickly.
Why? You analyze as well. Why aren't wages going up?
I do not have an answer for that. I was talking with an economist yesterday, or we had a brainstorming meeting, and that's more his area, and he did not have an answer.
So even economists don't have an answer for that. Will it change? I mean, we're talking about training for these jobs. We had Egan call earlier talk about jobs that you would think would pay a little bit more than what they do.
Right. And to speak to Egan's point, I mean, if you look at things as a whole, if you look at these numbers as a whole, you get averages, you get medians. But if you look sector by sector, there's different stories, right? Healthcare right now is growing in this region at a much stronger rate than a lot of other sectors, right? We're seeing a lot of merger activity.
Growing, meaning jobs or wages?
Both, actually. Okay. Yeah, both number of jobs, projected annual growth over the next 10 years, and also wages. If you're looking at advanced manufacturing, it's in a similar way too, right? Where we see the wages that are starting to tick up a little bit. So it really have to look at a more granular level to see trends across industries and sectors and even in specific occupations to see a little bit more of an in-depth story. But I do think that regardless, this we're talking about good problems here with unemployment rate in this region here is 3.2%. And as you said before, I'd rather have it 3.2 than 10.2. There are things that we need to look at with labor force participation rate. Why are wages not being as sticky as we would expect? Why are we not seeing them grow as fast? It really is an occupation or industry or sector by sector approach that we have to take. But overall, South Central Pennsylvania, we're excited about where this region is going. And I'm sure the Commonwealth too, Eileen, you could speak to that. And it's exciting because we're seeing businesses move here and we're seeing job seekers move here. And I think long term, these are good structural areas that we're going to see growth in.
We only have a few minutes left. Deputy Secretary Cipriani, a couple final questions. If you could, I mean, you talked about industries where there is a need for skilled workers, but what are some of the specific jobs where skills are needed rather than just the training? I'm not just talking about the training, but where we need some jobs to be filled. And then also, again, I'll have you repeat what you did earlier about how someone listening can get information, get involved in a training program, or get some more education.
Well, Jesse hit the big one, healthcare. Right, Commonwealth-wide healthcare is a growth industry and will continue to be a growth industry. We have an aging workforce, an aging population in Pennsylvania, so we're going to continue to see that grow. Construction, there are a lot of construction jobs in the Commonwealth, and what we hear from the construction industry is they have an aging workforce. The same with manufacturing, advanced manufacturing, an aging workforce. So we have skilled jobs there, tool and die, CNC machining. Industrial maintenance is one of the jobs that we can never fill enough individuals to fill those jobs, especially when you look at automation and robotics, to be able to program and maintain that equipment in a logistics operation, in a manufacturing operation, that is really an important and key component there. So if you're looking for additional training, you're looking to move forward in your job, get additional skills, please visit us at our PA CareerLink sites throughout the state. As I said, there's 57 of them, plus PA CareerLink online. We actually have a great website there that you could look on and get information. And once you find what you need, you could apply there, or you could come down and visit us for in-person services in the state.
And we will have a link to your website on our website, WITF.org/smarttalk. Eileen Cipriani, Jesse McCree, Jeff Newman, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Scott.
Thank you, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. All right, I had a little hesitation there. I had to say goodbye to everyone in our first segment of the program. By the way, we have a Smart Talk road trip coming up tomorrow. We'll be at the Susquehanna Art Museum in Harrisburg tomorrow, Midtown Harrisburg. Museum has an exhibit, Picasso, A Life in Print. Still time if you're interested in attending and watching the show being produced and also get to go through the museums, just see some of the best art that you will see here in Central Pennsylvania. That's coming up on tomorrow's program. You know, literally thousands of books have been written about President Abraham Lincoln. So one that is written that is unique, it stands out. Joseph Roda's book, Abraham Lincoln and Making a Case, The Story of a Master, is different from the great majority of books on Lincoln. Joseph Roda is with us right now to talk about the book. Mr. Roda, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Scott. It's a pleasure and a privilege.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So what prompted you to write this book?
What prompted me was suggestions that were received as a result of doing a series of lectures, starting all the way back in 2009 on Lincoln. It began with the thesis that Lincoln's years in the courtroom so shaped his approach to persuasion that even outside the courtroom, he remained the courtroom lawyer. The first presentation that I made was entitled Abraham Lincoln, Trial Lawyer in Chief. And as I would give more of these presentations to attorneys and lay people, the reading increased, the notes increased, they began to separate themselves into topics, a manuscript. It was a labor of love. I've been a Lincoln fan forever and also very interested because of my work in what worked and did not work in persuasion. It was fun to do this.
So in the book, you write that there's very little, if anything, that is new in the book that people can, those 15,000 books of Lincoln that on Lincoln that I talked about, you've probably heard these stories, but you approach it in a different way. How is it unique in that how you look at Lincoln's life and career?
When I say that there is nothing new in the book, I'm referring primarily to the history of Lincoln's speeches, from the little boy who jumped on a tree stump to repeat verbatim a sermon he had just heard, all the way to his last statement before the assassination. What is unique is the presentation of that history by itself. Biographies of Lincoln, of course, mention his successes at speech, his Gettysburg addresses, inaugural addresses. But they mention them in the midst of the many other facets of Lincoln's incredibly complex and diverse life. I mean, he was 19th century American Shakespeare, and that's why you have 400-page biographies of him. This takes the facts dealing with his ability to persuade and treats only them. And then secondly, what I would like to think is unique is the second part of the book. After tracing what he does, the question in the second part leads off with what made him so good. And there we break down in a way that I have not seen, or an extent that I have not seen in other books. We break down the things, the components, the elements that made him so effective in persuasion, either on his feet or on paper.
What are they?
Personality, intellect, his masterful credibility, clarity, fact, logic, and use of emotion, those things. Now, you'll see those mentioned in biographies, but you'll see them mentioned sometimes a couple in a sentence, that he was simple and clear or modest, whatever. We take one of those and develop it in much more detail with, as the rest of the book does, using the views of contemporaries. The people who saw him in action at the time, saw and heard him, the people who were so impressed at hearing him, even people who disagreed with him on his policies, especially the expansion of slavery, they would come away saying, I like that man. He doesn't make you mad the way the others do. Or that was the best speech against slavery I've ever heard. And some would say that was the best speech of any kind I have ever heard. And it was remarkable, really, to think that this came from a person with less than a year of formal education, and that in a backwoods one-room schoolhouse, where he was probably pretty quickly smarter than the person who was teaching him. It was all self-taught in an age of oratory, where every good school taught oratory and rhetoric, and trained rhetoricians abounded. In this mix, this man, self-taught totally, rose above all others to the highest position in the country and to the respect not only of the country but the world.
And I want to just take a step backwards, because you mention this often, especially in the first part of the book, that even though there were so many people who came away impressed with Lincoln, as you said, you gave many examples of people saying, that's the best speech I ever heard, or, man, that guy, he was something else. But, and let's face it, human beings do this. Appearance is one of the first things they notice. You mention in the book often that even at a time when there wasn't television, there wasn't photography in the first part of Abraham Lincoln's life, that very often the first impression people would get of Abraham Lincoln is, man, this guy is not very good looking, and he looks like a country bumpkin, he didn't dress well. But yet then they changed their minds as they listened to him speak. But he had to get over that appearance. That was a challenge.
He was totally non-presidential in his appearance. He was gawky, 6'4", 180, with arms that were so disproportionately long that his critics called him the ape or the gorilla. And he walked in a funny way, clop, clop, as opposed to a more graceful way. His Cooper Union experience is perhaps as good on that as anything. He was invited in February of 1860 to come and address a very prominent group in New York City. He knew it would be a make-or-break moment for him because nobody was going to get the nomination without the backing of that.
Mm-hmm.
The first person who met him when he got off the train had an, oh my God, what have I done moment. He said it was the most discouraging image of a person he'd ever seen. Others on the organizing committee came to say hello in the day before. They likewise felt, oh, what have we done to this crowd that is coming tonight? When he first appeared on the stage, there were people who said they literally pitied him for the way he looked. But within minutes of his beginning to speak, the crowd changed. By the end of that speech, the crowd was on its feet. People were saying he was the greatest man since St. Paul. They said that when he began to speak, his features took on a different semblance. His features changed. He lit up. There was a passion about it that's totally made people forget their initial impressions and converted them to a belief that this was indeed somebody to be reckoned with.
You said all along that even after he became president, that Abraham Lincoln was at heart a courtroom lawyer.
Yes.
Why do you say that?
I think it's clear. Really, what got me started on even the lectures was reading Doris Kearns Goodwin's book, Team of Rivals. Footnote here, she was my senior thesis advisor in college. I'm a fan of her books.
One of my favorite books, by the way.
Fan of her books. And I noticed, could not help but notice, that the excerpts of his political speeches sounded so much like a trial lawyer's opening or closing address, statement of the issue, statement of the facts, statement of the argument, and then the request for whatever you wanted to do, not guilty or award damages, etc. And that led me to investigate his legal career more. I mean, we all knew he was a lawyer before he was president. But I found out that he and his partners, his three partners, handled about 5,000 cases. They tried to verdict more than 1,000 cases. Now, that's a remarkable number. And when you consider that Lincoln's third partnership lasted 16 of his 25 years, and where he was the trial lawyer, he tried the majority of those. And standing day by day in front of regular townsfolk, and he rode a 1,500-mile circuit, stopping to handle legal cases in each of the county seats along the way. When you do that many times, seeking to persuade, if you're a student of persuasion, as Lincoln was, you learn very quickly what works and what doesn't. And you see the effects of it. This was the age of oratory, as I mentioned, where orators were bombastic, multi-syllable words that impressed people even if they didn't understand what they meant. Not Lincoln. Lincoln was words of one syllable. He knew that the first step to persuasion is comprehension. 70%, more than 70% of the words in perhaps his two most famous addresses, the Gettysburg Address and the second inaugural, are words of just one syllable. One newspaper put it especially well, I thought. They say he speaks as though the people were listening to their own thinking out loud.
Mm. You mentioned his two most famous speeches. Did he have a favorite? I mean, Gettysburg Address, that's the one that every school child in America has memorized over the years.
Yes.
But it seems, though, from what I've read, even in your book, that second inaugural was his favorite.
Yes, he is reputed to have passed a butler, I believe, in the White House with the manuscript rolled up. And he said, in passing, a lot of wisdom in that thing, I think. And immediately after the second inaugural, at the massive reception at the White House that was held, Frederick Douglass came in. And Lincoln was a great admirer of Douglass. And he said, Douglass, what did you think of it? He was anxious to have Douglass's reaction. And Douglass said, Mr. President, that was a sacred effort. And apparently Lincoln was very pleased about that.
Mm. So just, and as you write, there was a message in that inauguration. Ooh. And it was geared toward
reconciliation. It was very much a political sermon. when you look at all of the biblical references that he made there, when he asked the country to accept the idea that it wasn't just the South that was responsible for slavery, it was the entire country, everybody, coffee, sugar, and that, he asked, he appealed to the country to listen to the better angels of our nature and bring ourselves together now that the war was virtually over.
Joseph Rutta, author of the book Abraham Lincoln and Making a Case, The Story of a Master. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Scott, for the invitation.